Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. What would happen if your world turned upside down? Well, consider our story today. In February of 1942, a U.S. Navy ship called the Truxton found itself shipwrecked in a terrible storm off the coast of Newfoundland. Most of the men on board died. Thanks to the quick actions of the townspeople of nearby St. Lawrence, 46 sailors survived. One of them was a black man from Georgia named Lanier Phillips. But it wasn't so much the shipwreck that turned his world upside down as what came next. After experiencing a lifetime of racism, both at home and in the military, Phillips was suddenly confronted with white people who comforted him instead of abused him. He was so confused by this turn of events that it caused him to question everything he had ever believed about himself and his destiny. In our program today, Phillips looks back 50 years later on his life and how the people of St. Lawrence changed it. Today's soundprint from Chris Brooks is called Survivor.
You turn left up here by the stop sign.
Okay.
It's very good. You see the high school's down there.
St. Lawrence, Newfoundland, Canada. Population 1,697 souls. Before the mine closed, they were miners and fishermen. A 5-hour drive from the city, perched at the tip of a rocky peninsula, jutting into the North Atlantic.
Now just keep on going.
Ina Edwards is the unofficial town historian. She's taking me to see the new school playground. But before we get there, there's a whole story to tell. A story that begins 3,000 kilometers south of here, in DeKalb County, Georgia, USA.
Now this is from the 20 millimeter shells that some of the, that washed ashore, they dived down and got it.
This is off the Truxton.
Off the Truxton. And the people of St. Lawrence gave me this. And if you'll step in here, I'll show you what I have in here. Down at this end, at the very, that's St. Lawrence.
That photograph.
Yeah, that's St. Lawrence. Now, here's my grandmother, great-grandmother and grandfather, who were born slaves. I don't know exactly when he was born, but I know she was born in 1852. Well, I'm Lanier Phillips. I was born March 14th, 1923. And I live in DeKalb County. And DeKalb County didn't finish schools for black people until 1939. They didn't want the blacks to have any kind of education. I remember hearing the grown-ups say that the white people say they call them Negroes back then. If said educated Negro was unfit for a slave, you can't control him if he gets an education. So don't let him get an education, you know, keep him from that, and then we can control him. Then they had the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, and they instilled fear in the black people. At least they tried, and I know they had fear into me from 5 or 6 years old. I would go up and see them come down Main Street marching every Saturday night, and then at other times they would be on this truck and they would fire a shot in the air or something like that. And I knew which way they were going. When they crossed the railroad track, if they kept going straight, I knew they was going to a place called Smoker Road, predominantly black. Well, it was all black. But if they made a right turn, I knew they was coming down to what we call Bruce's Alley, where I live. And I'd take off like a jackrabbit and tell people they're coming. And everybody would put the lamps out. They didn't have electricity. But they did. They did some terrible things. They would come in and bring the men out and whip them if they violated any of their rules, the Ku Klux Klan rule. And it was looking back, it was just terrible. Everybody was a Klan. The police was a Klan. The grocery store owners were a Klan. They didn't care, but a lot of them would wear the hoods and things like that. For what reason, I don't know. I guess the same reason a military man wears a uniform. It was part of the, you know, the dress code, I guess, was to put the sheet, we call it, and the dunce hat on. But black people had a chance to go to a so-called school. They would build a school themselves. I was going to a school they call Yellow River, but the Ku Klux Klan burned the school down, you know. Yes, sir, they burned. I remember that clear. I can close my eyes and see the flames going, standing and watching the school burn and listen to the grown-ups, you know, say, they'll never let us learn or let our children learn to read, you know.
What did it look like? I mean, what did you see through your eyes those nights?
Well, I saw no future. I had no dreams, because only thing I could say, well, maybe I'll be a sharecropper or something, you know, once I grew up. So I said, I think I'll join the Navy.
12:15 in New York, and the International Division of the National Broadcasting Company brings you now the latest news of the day. United States Secretary of War Stimson announced this forenoon that the Japanese battleship Haruna had been sunk off the northern coast of Luzon in the Philippines. This declaration by the War Secretary came a bare hour before the United States Congress was to convene to hear a message from President Roosevelt asking for a declaration of war upon Germany and Italy, which powers, 3 hours earlier, had made formal declaration of war upon the United States.
So in 1941, I joined the Navy. Well, they had blacks in one place and whites in another. And blacks better not, you know, interfere, go down to the whites, you know, showers or bathroom or anything like that. And the blacks on board ship, they could only be mess attendants, serving and taking what they call taking care of your officer. You were assigned a certain amount of officers. You kept his shoes shine, his clothing, you know, ready, and his room clean. And you'd be out for 30 days or more. You had to wash those officers' underwear. And I went aboard ship. My first ship was the Truxton. And, well, on board ship, they had mess hall, like, and they'd take the tables down from the overhead and set them up for the whites to eat. The whites sat. The blacks had nowhere to sit to eat. They had to stand and eat. The officers had a wardroom with chairs and table, a tablecloth and, you know, china and all, and we would serve them. They would sit there and eat, but all the blacks had to stand in this little pantry and eat.
February the 18th, 1942. The south coast of Newfoundland. Night.
The home port was Boston. Once we left Boston, we slept what we call ready roll. We didn't pull our clothing off because we knew that the submarines were there.
Marine forecast for Newfoundland, port south coast, storm warning. Winds northerly, 15 to 20 knots, increasing to northwest, 30 this evening, and to northerly gales, 40.
Well, I was the junior mess boy, they call it, and I would take coffee on the bridge to the officers, and I heard the XO, the executive officer, tell the captain, say, this is going to be a rough one.
I'm Gus Echegaray. I was about 16 and a half in 1942. A young fellow just finished high school in St. Lawrence. It was a huge, it was a hell of a storm. I don't know what the estimate of the winds would be, but it had the full strife of the Atlantic.
And I guess many people said, maybe it was even said in our house, what a dreadful night. We fitted for sailors on the sea tonight.
Truxton had no radar. So what they did was relying on dead reckoning.
Before they knew it, they're right into the cliff. Bang.
I thought we had been torpedoed. I didn't know what. I was in my bed when it hit. Down I came. I had all my clothes on. I had my life jacket. And I grabbed a pair of shoes. I didn't know if it was mine or what. And went topside. Well, it was dark. And it was storming. I mean, it was picking the Truxton up. And it looked like just slam it against the rock. And you could hear the steel grinding. Then when day began to break, they finally turned on the big searchlight, and all you could see was the cliffs and the rocks. It was like between two rocks, like, and Wash began to wash the fellows overboard. I almost got washed over two or three times, but I grabbed their lifeline and hold on.
At about 7:30 in the morning, my father called and in a somewhat frantic voice said, get down here as quickly as you can, get a hold of the driver of that pickup truck, load up all the ropes and lines that you could find in the area, and get down to Chambers Cove.
The ship had begun to take on so much water, we knew it was, you know, going to sink. They had said that no man could live in the water more than 5 minutes because of the cold.
As we came up over the hill and looked down, you know, here 300 feet or so below, right in the middle of a sort of a horseshoe cove, this destroyer, this Truxton, partly submerged, but the full length of the rail was still above water. All these people hanging on, if you like, to dear life on the rail. Some were just swept up on those jagged cliffs and then you tumble down and so on. It was a pretty dreadful sight.
About this time, she began to break and all the oil had come out. Oil was coming out. And everybody looked like little rats in the water covered with that crude oil.
I, along with others, went down hand over hand on a rope.
I told her, other blacks that were standing there with me, I said, well, you know, we're going to die. I said, if we stay on board this ship, I said, at least we can die fighting. I said, let's go. When I jumped in there, it was like I felt just one quick pain, like that went over my entire body, and it was all over. I didn't feel any pain after that. I just felt sleepy.
And the heavy bunker sea oil was beginning to come into the shoreline, and the water, salt water, would rise and then recede. And as it receded, you'd see this black hulk, you know, digging in, clutching onto the rocks and waiting for somebody to run and grab them and try to save them.
And when we got ashore, I said, well, I made it here. I might as well die. You know, so I just laid down there on the beach and I closed my eyes to die, you know. And this fella came and he said, get him up. Don't let him lie there. Say, pick him up. Say, he'll surely die if he lays there. I say, walk him around. So he pulled me up. And from there, it brought life to me. I said, man, here's a white person who wants me to live. And if I had been in Georgia, they'd say, kick him out of the way, you know. Let's help these white people. Then I think I passed out.
They took them to the where there was a temporary first aid station. And, of course, the call came to the women to clean them. And that's where the story came in at Lenaire. Now, the little funny story. See, he was there among all the other survivors. The ladies were cleaning them up and scrubbing them up. Because they were covered with tar. They were so filthy. They had to be, every part of them had to be washed. So when he opened his eyes,
I could see these white ladies all around. There I was, stark naked on this table. And I heard one of the ladies say, "This is the curliest hair I've ever seen." I said, "Oh, boy, this is the end of me, you know." And then she said,
"This poor fellow, the tar went right into his pores. I'm scrubbing and scrubbing, and I can't get him clean."
You know, and I spoke up. She said, "Can't get it." I said, "Well, you can't get it off. It's the color of the skin."
And she said, "Oh, I'll get it off all right." And so she continued to scrub. Violet Pike, but she's dead now. She had never seen a black man before. So, I mean, she didn't differentiate. She just thought he was a white man with the black into his pores so bad she couldn't get it out.
And I was thinking, oh, boy, are they going to lynch me? Here I am. If I had been in Georgia, they would have ran those white women out of town and maybe lynched me for letting them bathe me, you know?
And, of course, when the men were taking him out to the different homes, she said, "Bring him to my home." So that evening, then, she prepared supper. And he was amazed that he ate with the family. And he drank out of china cups, the same as the family.
And they put me in the bed. And this lady, she would come in and say, "Are you warm? Are you all right?" And she did this the remainder of the night. I didn't go to sleep anymore because I was still afraid. I didn't know where I was or what was going to happen to me. But then I kept asking myself, did I die? And, you know, and I went to heaven. What's going on? Well, it hasn't been a day pass since that happened. It hasn't been a day pass I didn't think about St. Lawrence. They changed my entire philosophy of life. So they gave me leave. I think I got 15 days leave. And I went to see my aunt who lived in Chattanooga. And we would catch the bus from there to go into town. And the blacks had to sit behind the whites. So when we got on, the back seat was filled. And here was this white guy. So we sat in the seat in front of him. He reached and grabbed me by the neck and said, "Nigga, don't you sit in front of me." And I was going to fight him. I felt like fighting him then because of the treatment I got in St. Lawrence and what the people have treated me like a human being. I said, "Well, hell, I'm a human. I'm no longer a slave in the lowest and the least, the last." I say, "If I can give my life and fight this war the same as everybody else and can't even ride a bus when I pay the same fare as everybody else," my mother, my aunt said, "Just be quiet, just be quiet." Said, "We'll be in a few minutes." So I thought about that. They sent me to Jacksonville, Florida. And when I got to Jacksonville, I was hungry. And when I got off and walked into the station, I saw all these prisoners, Italian and German prisoners, and they had army MPs, Americans. Got them. They had them inside the dining room eating. And I knew that the blacks could go to a window or something somewhere, but I knew they wouldn't be allowed to go into that dining room. And I thought about the people of St. Lawrence, how they had fed me, gave me clothing and put me in their bed. So I went in to ask, you know, where does the colored, is what they call us then, where can the colored Negroes, you know, get something to eat? And this one cop grabbed me by the collar and slung me on the ground and actually pull his gun out and pull the hammer back. I could hear it click. He said, "You black son of a bitch, I blow your black brains out." He said, "You know better than to come in here where these white people are." So the white people were the German prisoners in the Italian prison. And here I am in an American uniform. I thought about the people of St. Lawrence. From there, they called me a troublemaker and was transferred there to Corpus Christi, Texas. They had a special table for the blacks who worked in the officers' barracks to eat. We could sit down, but we had to go way back in the corner to this special table. So I told them, I didn't want no special table. So I don't want that. I said, don't do me any special favors. I said, treat me as a human being, as a sailor, the same as the rest of the sailors. He said, all right, going back to the barracks. When I got down the barracks, a messenger came down and said, Phillips, pack your sea bag and hammock. You're being transferred. You got 2 hours. They said I was causing problems. I was tired of shining shoes. I was tired of washing dishes and pots and pans. I was tired of it. I had 17 years in the Navy then as a mess attendant. I wanted to learn a trade. And I wrote the first black congressman, and I wrote the Bureau of Naval Personnel a letter and told them I thought I was qualified to be something other than a mess attendant. And I did get a chance to go to sonar school by pushing and fighting for it. And when I got that letter back saying report to Fleet Sonar School, I really gave the credit to St. Lawrence. Because had it not been for St. Lawrence, I wouldn't have been writing, you know, the powers to be. I got orders to report to Fleet Sonar School. They called me down. Counselor wants to see you. And I went in to see the counselor. Phillips said, we got good news. We've contacted Washington, and they go along with it and make you chief steward, mess attendant. He said, because we don't think you can make it through Sonar School. I said, well, sir, you can take the first class if you want. I said, but just don't throw me out. He said, well, you know you're going to flunk out, don't you? I said, no, I don't know that. I said, give me a chance. If I flunk out, so be it. He said, all right, you start the next class. So I started the next class, and I went through sonar school. And when I went aboard the ship, the Bailey, I walked up. I saluted the flag and saluted the OD, the officer of the deck. And he told the messenger, who's always there, said, show him where the mess attendant's compartment. I said, no, sir. I said, I'm sonar tech. He said, you what? I said, I'm sonar tech.
The screams of gassed, beaten, and trampled Negro civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama were heard around the world last Sunday.
The next day, I said, I'm going to Selma.
The possibility of further violence seemed certain. As another,
I wanted to be a part of that because I knew that it was worth fighting to be a human being. And that's why I went to Selma.
It'll be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse, your orders to disperse.
And I looked at this man and said, why can't this white man be like the white people of St. Lawrence?
They turn around and disperse.
I have no hatred for the Ku Klux Klan or any human being. I pray for these people, these racists and bigots, that something will happen to make them change, as happened to me, and make them change and look at all people as God's children, and not look at people as a white, a brown, or a black, but look at him as a human being, and I believe that eventually they will. I may not see it. They will.
There's the board right there. Look.
And now it's 58 years since the shipwreck. And in St. Lawrence, there's this playground.
See, there's the playground. Established by the students of Marion Elementary School in 1999. If you can go almost into it, you can go in.
I'm not a rich man, but every contribution I can make, I make it to the people of St. Lawrence. I realize since the mine closed, the economy is way down.
He has shown gratitude, no doubt about it, you know. And they're trying to get a new playground for the elementary school. And I said, well, I have a nice check to present from Lanier.
I'd said, do whatever the society wants to do with this. I said, but I would like for you to do something for your museum and let the world know what you did for the entire crew of the Truxton.
There, look. Lanier Phillips, USS Truxton survivor. And then on the other side is the USS Truxton, lost February 18, 1942. And the Marion Elementary School logo is in the center. And the name of the playground is Lanier Phillips Playground.
I just want the people of St. Lawrence to know how much I appreciate them. And I want them to know what they did for me. They put into my mind, it's etched in there, it's solid, like liquid steel. Hot steel became cold and solid. It's into me. And it'll never leave me.
Survivor was produced by Chris Brooks of Battery Radio. You can visit us anytime you'd like online at soundprint.org. We have listening links for all of our weekly programs and research links that'll send you to the far corners of the internet while you listen. That address again is soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. On the next Soundprint, whether New York yellow or London black, taxicabs around the world have something in common: the drivers.
You still have to watch what you're doing. You still want to keep your doors locked. When you're rolling down streets, you want to make sure people are just not too messed up, drunk, or on drugs.
Taxis, next week on Soundprint. You can own your favorite Soundprint episodes on CD for a small fee by calling 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. We want to hear back from you, and it won't cost a dime. Get in touch by emailing talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.